Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
A test of Biden's foreign policy, extricating the United States from the catastrophic Saudi war in Yemen. Discussion with Yemen's Nobel Peace Prize winner and author Robert Worth. Then, a picture is worth a thousand words. Impeachment managers bring startling new evidence to Trump's Senate trial. Also ahead.
We're hungry, right?
Starving.
A new series, actor Stanley Tucci's Grand Tour of Italy.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. President Joe Biden is plowing ahead with his foreign policy agenda against the backdrop in Washington of holding his predecessor accountable for a breach of democracy. Biden is imposing sanctions on Myanmar's generals after their coup, and he's discussing human rights abuses in his first call with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The White House has already taken steps on the world's worst humanitarian disaster, and that is Yemen, announcing a suspension of arms sales to the Saudi-led offensive there. The U.S. is also calling upon the Saudi kingdom to release political prisoners. And overnight, women's rights activist Lujan Al-Hathloul was indeed released after more than 1,000 days in a Saudi jail. Now, for a closer look, I'm joined by the Yemeni journalist and Nobel Peace Prize winner, Tawakkol Karman, and by Robert Worth, a former Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times, who has written extensively about Saudi Arabia and the region. Welcome both of you to the program. Let me ask you first, Tawakkol, about what you make of Lujain's release, because her family is calling it, you know, a release without freedom, so to speak.
Yes. Exactly. It is a release without freedom. The Saudi regime released Lujain Al-Hathloul, and still they put her in some kind of house arrest. She couldn't leave Saudi. She is under the travel ban and her family. So we can't say that Lujain is free. No, Lujain is still under kind of arrest. They should free her. They should lift the ban on her traveling and on her family also traveling. And also those people who committed arresting her and torturing her should be held accountable. The same thing with all prisoners in Saudi, political prisoners and activists prisoners in Saudi. We hope that they will get their freedom soon.
So let me ask you, because you yourself obviously are a woman, a woman's rights activist, and she is herself the most prominent one in Saudi Arabia. This is what her family stated. Any release that does not include an independent investigation of the charges, does not include lifting the travel ban, does not include dropping the charges, is not freedom. Therefore, we're far away from justice. You've alluded to that, Tawakkol, but why do you think Saudi Arabia has taken this step at this time?
Saudi Arabia now under the pressure of Biden administration. And I think Saudi and every dictator, you know, in the world will, if America is serious on supporting human rights, if America is serious in supporting democracy, they will rethink on, you know, using oppression against their citizen or against any other countries. Well, the current situation that happened, the current violence that happened by Saudi regime is because they got green light from American administration, previous American administration, and also from the international community when they attacked Yemen in their war in Yemen, when they killed Jamal Khashoggi, when they arrested tens or hundreds of activists and scholars and, you know, political prisoners, when they committed war crimes. So that was, you know, a result of green light of the international community, started with the United States. And now with the new administration and with the promises of Joe Biden and his administration that they will collaborate and they will ally with people, with human rights defenders, with the democratic people around the world, I think they will bring a big solution for all the people around the world, for all the conflict around the world, and they will stop the, you know, tyranny and terrorism and chaos and, you know, around the world with supporting democratic people.
Okay, so let me put that to Bobby Worth, who has spent a career focusing on Saudi Arabia and the region. Do you think that sounds like putting too much hope in the Biden administration? What do you think this administration will be able to do to change Saudi behavior, to change what it's doing in Yemen? And take us back to, it wasn't Trump that got U.S. into Yemen. It was actually under President Obama.
That's right. And I think political will is a good thing. In that sense, I agree with Tawakkol. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult to change what's happening in Yemen. First of all, let me say the release of Hussein al-Hafez is a wonderful thing. It's obviously a signal from the Saudis to the Biden administration, an effort to placate them and to begin this process, which is all about, you know, I mean, the Saudis had embraced the Trump administration in a really, let's say, public way. And I think it's, you know, it created a sense among Democrats in Congress that even more than before, I mean, let's face it, Saudi already had a bad image, particularly, let's say, among the Democrats. But I think Saudi, you know, especially after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, entered this realm of being almost, you know, part of a sort of evil, access of evil. You know, there was a real sense that this government, that the kingdom was doing terrible things, which obviously they are in Yemen. But I think what that did is to set up false expectations. It's not going to be easy to fix these problems. First of all, there's the question of MBS's, Mohammed bin Salman's image, because we know that he ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That's going to be tricky and difficult. Second of all, what's happening in Yemen is a long war. It began as a civil war, then it became an international war. I think it's a very good thing, as Tawakkol said, that the Biden administration has signaled political will and, in fact, you know, sent an envoy, Tim Lenderking, a veteran diplomat, to be part of this process. That's all very good. But the Saudis already want to get out of Yemen. They've been wanting to get out of Yemen for a long time. The question is how to do it. And there you have to talk about their adversaries, the Houthis, who control most of Yemen and are a very difficult, fanatical, mercurial group.
Okay, well, let me ask you that question then, because you have been studying this. How do you get the Saudis extricated from Yemen if they want to? How do you? What, as you've just pointed out, there's so many players, and Tawakkol knows this because she's been on the ground, obviously. So many players. It's a proxy war, amongst many other things there. How do you get, how do you end it?
Well, the Biden administration has already taken some good steps. I mean, they're reversing the Trump administration's last-minute declaration that the Houthis were a terrorist group. That only made it more difficult to conduct diplomacy, and diplomacy is the name of the game here. But, you know, the UN under Martin Griffiths has been engaged in this diplomatic process to try to end the war. It's been very, very difficult with little progress. You know, the Houthis, and I think it's important to give a bit of context here. In fact, I met Tawakkol. Tawakkol, I don't know if you remember this, but we met for the first time in June 2008 in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, at the sentencing of a journalist whose alleged crime was having written in support of or written about the Houthis, which then were, you know, this group in the far remote northwest of the country that nobody really understood. And even today, there's something of a mystery about what the Houthis want. They are, as I said, a fanatical group. They've been very inconsistent. And when you deal with them, you know, they send out people to speak to diplomats and so forth. I mean, I've met with Houthi officials in the Yemeni capital and even up in the northwest in Sada. But the people that I meet with are not the people making the decisions. And very often there's a real difference between the two. I mean, one of the things you can point to in the difficulty of dealing with the Houthis, there's a huge oil tanker that's been for years on Yemen's Red Sea coast. And there's an urgent need to make sure that it doesn't spill. It's got enormous amounts of oil that could become just an absolute environmental catastrophe. Well, the Houthis have been unwilling to guarantee the safety of the UN's, efforts to fix that. So, you know, these are not easy people to talk to.
So let me ask Tawakkol, because as you say, you both have been so intimately involved on different angles of this story. So regarding the Houthis and how to get them, to change their behavior, Tawakkol, you've written last month in the Washington Post, the Biden administration should also exert maximum pressure on the Houthis to retreat from their coup and to return to what was previously agreed by the Yemenis at the National Dialogue Conference, and on Iran to stop its interference in Yemen and stop supplying the Houthis with machines of destruction and death. So do you think, Tawakkol, that it is as simple or as direct a route to get Iran to stop the Houthis?
Look, Christiana, first, you should know that the problem with Houthis is an internal matter of Yemenis. And we started to solve it through the national dialogue after the peaceful revolution, after our first step victory against, the dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh, when we forced him to resign. We entered to the national dialogue with the militia of al-Houthi and with all Yemeni parts. We did a great progress. But the problem came when the outsiders interfere in Yemeni issue, when Saudi, Emirates, and Iran supported parties. Iran supported, the Houthi militia, and Houthi and Saudi and Emirates waged their war against Yemen. So the exactly problem here in Yemen is first is the proxy war. Is the practicing the hegemony and guardianship from Saudi and Emirates. If we want to force Houthis to be committed to their commitment in the national dialogue, or to stay with Yemenis in national another national dialogue that we call for. And I know that Yemenis can solve their problems if Saudi and Emirates stop their war in Yemen, mm-hmm. if they stop their guardianship of Yemen, if they stop their supporting another militias in Yemen. So with Houthis, we can force Houthis either with peace or with another, mechanisms, which is, I am, as a Nobel Peace Prize, I committed to the non-violence. But with the interference from outsiders, from Iran, from Saudi, from Emirates, okay. It's really, really complicated. So the solution is that Biden should be serious on that matter. He should be serious on that matter.
Okay.
It is not just stopping the war, stopping the bombs that came from Saudi to Yemen. No, it's more than that. They have to stop their hegemony and guardianship, and their direct and indirect. Even militia of al-Houthi, they don't have just the support from Iran, by the way. They have indirect support from Saudi, and that is another big story. We can explain it. So, yeah, with Houthis, we can make a dialogue, and we are Yemenis. We can solve our problems. And Houthis, you said, Christian, about, lifting Houthis, as a terrorist, group from Biden administration. Houthis committed a very terrorist action against Yemen. They destroyed Yemen as well as Saudi and Emirates, and Biden has to do great pressure on them and on Iran, and don't make it as a bargaining chips with Iran. This is very important.
Okay, let me put this, I don't have a huge amount of time, so let me put this to Bobby, because what she's saying, as you heard, is that all of the external powers need to be, brought to the table to stop this war on Yemen. Bobby, you've written a lot about MBS, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia. You wrote this last article, the latest article, on what you called sort of, I think you called it the delusion of utopia. In any event, he's building some city somewhere that's meant to be a utopia. I guess the big confusion for everybody is, can you separate Saudi Arabia from MBS? Where do you think his mindset is? Is he the kind of person that Biden can engage to just get out of this war and come to some sort of peace agreement around this war?
Well, there are many troubling things about MBS. I mean, from the murder of Khashoggi to what he's doing with these cities in the desert, which seem to be potentially a waste of enormous amounts of money that Saudi Arabia needs now that oil prices are so much lower. But I think with respect to Yemen, I think there MBS does know that he's got to get out. It's a ruinous war. The Saudis are not getting anything out of it. And in fact, you know, the contributions of Iran to the Houthis have gotten larger over the course of this war. In other words, the war that was started to stop Iran from being a thorn in their side has had the opposite effect. But I think, you know, for the Saudis, there are all kinds of difficulties in doing that. The command and control is of the Saudi military is so incredibly dysfunctional. It's just a broken tool. And I think, you know, when you talk about solving this war, it's one thing to say, let's have everybody withdraw. But remember, you know, there was also renewed diplomacy between the United States and Iran over the nuclear program. It may well be hard to separate that from what's going on in Yemen. You know, the Saudis now see Yemen as a way to inflict pain on Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, the ally of the United States. So it's two issues.
You mean the Iranians see Yemen?
The Iranians see Yemen, I think, now as a way to inflict pain on Saudi Arabia and thereby, to some extent, on the United States. So these two tracks, Yemen and Iran, are harder to separate now and make it more difficult.
Well, Yemen is you know, just stuck in between these big power proxies, and it will be really important to see whether this administration can exert any influence to bring, as we've described it, the world's worst humanitarian crisis to an end. I think, Tawakkol, 80% of your people depend on humanitarian aid right now. We will be continuing to follow this. Tawakkol Carmen, Bobby Wirth, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, in Washington, impeachment managers have been releasing new security cam video from inside Congress on that day, January 6th, showing just how close Trump's extremist supporters got to lawmakers. Is it impacting the Republican Senate jurors? President Joe Biden says it might be.
I watched some this morning. I think the Senate has a very important job to complete, and I think my guess is some minds may have been changed, but I don't know.
So joining me now on this case is Asha Rangappa. She is a former FBI special agent, and she teaches national security law at Yale University. Welcome to the program. Let me just ask you to react to the president, what we just played, that he think maybe some of this that's being shown to the so-called Senate jurors might be having an effect. What is your gut feeling about that?
Well, I hope so. Remember that these senators are supposed to be approaching with an open mind. And I think if they're doing that, the House managers are making an incredibly compelling case for both causation and intent, which are the two things that they really need to prove about President Trump's role in that insurrection. On top of that, a lot of that video is incredibly emotional. These are people who actually experienced it. The senators are watching this at the crime scene, and they themselves were the victims. So I think that in a normal world, they would be affected by it and potentially open to changing their minds. But, you know, this is not a normal trial, and they may have other concerns that influence their decision.
Yeah, well, Senator Lindsey Graham has already weighed in, and this is what he said on Fox News last night.
The not guilty vote is growing after today. I think most Republicans found the presentation by the House managers offensive and absurd.
So, you know, that's his mantra. Do you, though, think that people like Lindsey Graham are out of step with the majority of the American public? Because you've seen the latest polls, and by quite a, you know, it is a majority, but it's a narrow majority. The majority, according to CBS, says that 56% want and vote to convict Trump, and 44 would acquit. Apparently, it's a much bigger majority when you ask them, do they think Trump had anything to do with January 6th? But do the senators risk being completely out of step with their constituents?
Yes, I think they do. And I think you're making an incredibly important point, Christiane, which is that the purpose of this impeachment trial isn't just to convince the senators who are acting as a jury. It's also to tell the story about what happened to the American people and to create a historical record of that narrative and set a precedent to put on paper that this action was an impeachable offense, and also to set the precedent that a former president can be tried. So this is serving a lot of other purposes beyond just the vote that the senators are going to ultimately come out with. You know, remember that also that these senators, some of them participated in elements of the narrative that the House managers are presenting. Many of them also echoed the big lie about the election, or helped to plan speeches and participated in these rallies that Trump had put together in the months leading up to it, and even on the day of. So I think that what Lindsey Graham says is not as important as this being placed on the historical record.
So that's, you know, very important, as you say, placing it on the historical record. And also, how surprised were you, after all the video you've seen and we've all seen since January 6th, by the latest, you know, CCTV stuff or security camera stuff from inside Congress that was presented in the latest session, to see Mike Pence, Senator Romney, Chuck Schumer, and the others actually physically being hustled out of danger, and to see in this video how close these senators who are now presiding came to this fanatical mob. And you could also see how heroic Officer Goodman was in trying to, you know, divert the mob from the senators and draw incoming to himself, so to speak.
Yes, that's a real key piece of the evidence that the House managers are presenting, which is the true harm that was caused by this. It wasn't just vandalizing the Capitol or disrupting a proceeding. These people were actually out to physically harm our members of Congress, and our members of Congress and the vice president were within minutes of potentially, you know, being physically injured, who knows what could have happened. I mean, we're very, very lucky that the casualties were, frankly, as low as they were that day. What I think the House managers have done very well with the video is present a story that they're telling, even in the absence of being able to call witnesses. And the star witness, by the way, Christian, is President Trump himself. We see him repeatedly juxtaposed with these scenes, with the comments that these insurrectionists were making, and how what he was saying, what he was tweeting, was being reflected in their actions and their words and what they intended to do when they were at the Capitol.
And just to point out, there is a latest group of these kind of, you know, Trump groups, these conspiracy groups, the leader of whom is saying that she waited specifically for what she called a directive from their commander-in-chief, the president, before, you know, taking part in this Capitol invasion. So there are more and more people who are actually saying that they took their message from the president's words and actions himself and themselves. So I want to ask you, you know, you said the most important witness is Trump. Well, his lawyer is going to start laying out their case tomorrow. And this is what he has said about the free speech argument that they're trying to make.
It's just a silly argument. It's not tied to Donald Trump or his speech whatsoever. So what they're doing now a bit is going back, well, you see, it's not just that speech. He's been, you know, inciting people, inflaming people. No, he's been rousing the American public to drain the swamp, whatever they call it on his side, to make a difference in this country. That's what political speech is about.
Is that a compelling legal argument?
No, that legal argument does not go anywhere as a legal matter. The president of the United States, as a public official, is accountable for what he says. You can kind of make the analogy to employment law. If in the course of your professional duties, you engage in particular kinds of speech, for example, hate speech or violent speech, you can be fired for it. You don't have a free speech argument. And so, you know, Trump, it would be the same as if he were, advocating in favor of our adversaries or perhaps, you know, using racial slurs. I mean, if he were engaging in speech that were destructive and not reflective of his office, he can be held liable for it. This isn't a criminal trial. He's not going to be sent to jail. Mm-hmm. And so the threshold for, you know, whether his, I think the threshold here is causality. It's not that he can say whatever he wants. It's that is what he said. Did he cause foreseeable harm? Did he intend that harm? And I think that in terms of making that link, the House managers are doing a great job. And I'll add that they have pointed out that even after this violence occurred, Trump did not use his position and his authority to stop it from continuing, despite repeated pleas to do so. His lawyers have an uphill battle. I think their free speech argument is the best they can do, but it's not, it doesn't hold water as a legal matter.
It's really fascinating. Asha Rangappa, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And to our viewers, I just want to read something that a former Republican congressman said in terms of whose side was Trump on. The obvious truth that is still so difficult to say out loud is that on January 6th, when our government was under attack by domestic terrorists, the president of the United States was on the side of the terrorists. This is from a former Republican congressman. But now we are going to make a sharp turn to La Dolce Vita with the award-winning actor Stanley Tucci. He's best known for his standout roles in films like The Devil Wears Prada and The Hunger Games. Now, inspired by his Italian heritage, he's turning his gaze to the home country, exploring it via its most famous global export, which is food. Here's a taste from his new 6-part series, Stanley Tucci, Searching for Italy.
The maestro is making a pizza for me.
Oh, my God. That's one of the best martinis I've ever had in my life.
If you don't believe in God, you believe in tortellini. It's like a religion.
Appetizing, right? Well, the first episode takes place in Naples and the Amalfi Coast, and I caught up with Stanley Tucci just as he had finished filming to talk about eating his way across a country brimming with history and culture and during a pandemic. So, Stanley Tucci, welcome. It's good to see you. The truth is that we're both in London. We would have done this face-to-face in a normal manner had we not been deep in who knows what tier of lockdown. How did you actually, accommodate the filming to the crisis that we're in right now?
Well, it was interesting. The first 4 episodes were shot prior to the first lockdown. The second phase of it was shot afterward. So there were certain rules in place that, of course, you know, we stuck to, but it wasn't easy. And it's obviously, as we all know, life is not as enjoyable with a mask on and when you can't hug somebody.
Look, how did this come about? How did you decide to join this project?
Well, CNN came to me and asked if I had any ideas for a show, and I had a few different ideas. I was very surprised that they'd come. I said, why are you coming to me? But I did have some ideas for a show. And this was the third idea that I threw out to them. And I could see in their eyes that once you say, I'd like to do a show on Italian regional cooking and the forces that, you know, created the recipes and the dishes and all that. You see everyone go, oh yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we'd love to do that,
Stanley, I need to ask you, because this is actually CNN's first venture into this kind of programming since we lost our beloved Anthony Bourdain.
Yes, I know.
And I want to know whether that weighed on you. What were you thinking of as you took this on?
I was thinking, and I knew Anthony a bit, and I loved his show. But this is a distinctly different show. To me, I had to be truthful to what I wanted to achieve, which was to really just focus on Italy and focus on the diversity of dishes in all of those regions. When people think of Italy, they think often that it's always sunny, people are eating pasta, and everybody's happy all the time, and they're drinking wine and limoncello. Now, part of that is true. That is a part of Italy, but that is hardly all of Italy. Italy is so incredibly diverse simply because of where it's
situated geographically. Mm-hmm. If we think about it, it goes from the Alps all the way down to Lampedusa, which is 70 miles off the coast of Africa, and where so many immigrants mm-hmm. come in.
Well, Naples, the Naples Amalfi Coast episode, obviously encapsulates all of that. The migrant story, the different and diverse story of Italy, the pandemics of historical times. Talk to me about the deep frying episode.
Yeah, it's the beginnings of pizza, and of course, pizza is this is one of the reasons I think one of the reasons we wanted to go to Naples is because it's where pizza began, and pizza is probably the most loved food in the world. The thing that is so interesting is that pizza began with people frying dough in this incredibly poor, overcrowded city with very unsanitary conditions. They started cooking dough in hot oil, and maybe they put a little pepper on it, or maybe they put a little meat on it or something, whatever they had. And this was a way of killing all the germs and still giving yourself something to sustain yourself.
Fernando, la mia vita è cambiata.
Non si fa così grasso.
And you were pretty surprised. Is it the Marzano tomatoes, which are very, very famous, and you found the farm?
Yeah, San Marzano tomato is the ideal tomato. We find them in grocery stores everywhere. It says on the can, San Marzano tomato. Blah, 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 blah. Well, as it turns out, there's like 150 acres or something like that. This is very small plots of land that grow San Marzano tomatoes. There is no way, and an investigation was done by the New York Times, there's no way that all of these cans and jars of San Marzano tomato around the world are actually from San Marzano. It's a complete scam. So it's a very, very small amount that really are.
Who knew there'd be a scam or a black market in tomatoes around?
Well, yeah, there was one. There was also a scam and black market in prosciutto, which we focus on in one episode too. I mean, it was because it's a $2 billion business.
Okay.
In Italy.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Just going back to a little bit of the history, which I have to say, for me anyway, I just loved it. The beginning, you're walking through the cobble streets in the old town, and Elisabetta shows you these sort of almost like martyrdom stations in the walls that are hollowed out of the walls with people's pictures and votive candles and flowers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. We talk about at the beginning of the show that there are two things that are really important in Neapolitan culture, but I think particularly in Southern Italian culture, which is food and death. And these are little sort of shrines, I guess, to people who have passed away. And some of them are political figures or famous figures. There's a shot of Maradona, because Maradona was the king of the Naples soccer team. But then also just loved ones, people who passed away, and they're all over. And you have to remember too that these people are living in the shadow of this volcano that is still very, very active. And we see what happened. If you go to Pompeii or Herculaneum, you see what happened and can easily happen again.
Right. Actually, you do find homeless and migrants who are pitching up their own camps under the highways. There's this area called Scampia that was built for low-income families, low-income housing, but it never quite worked.
I said, I really want to show where Italy is now today and how they've had to deal with so much immigration. And in some ways they've dealt with it very well, in some ways they haven't dealt with it very well. But also the fact that regardless of whether they're immigrants or not, that Italy is a very, very poor country in so many ways to this day. And I think the immigrants have in some way shone a light on that. The camp, I suppose, where they live was incredibly well constructed and neat and tidy, and their kids go to school, and they kind of live these amazing lives, but under the radar. They're constantly being harassed by people, of course. But one of the things that they've done with some people who are Neapolitan is open up a co-op of sorts, a restaurant where they use their recipes and the recipes of Neapolitans. And they've created this incredible restaurant and a school for children. So yeah, it's this social experiment that is working like a charm. And people are employed, people are making money, and people are putting all of their knowledge and their goodness to a very positive end.
I must say, I was so glad that you highlighted that, because, you know, it it does show in this era that we live in of the demonization of immigrants and migrants and people who flee violence in their own homes, how much good can come out of it if they're put to work. How did this compare with, you know, being an actor? What sort of different muscles did you have to use for this?
That was hard sometimes to... It's the opposite of acting. As an actor, you'll wait around on set forever. And then you might work like an hour a day. Mm-hmm. With something like this, you're constantly moving. You're in a location for one day, then you're moving someplace else the next day. So you're never really settling in. And the days can end up being quite long. I think the other thing is, and it may sound funny, but you're eating and drinking all the time. So then what do you do at the end of the day? You know what I mean? So by the end, you
drop into a sugar coma.
I know. You, by the end of the day, you go, I never, ever want to eat Italian food again.
Except you have a whole 6 episodes in which you have to eat your way through Italy.
Yes.
Anyway, Stanley Tucci, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And the first episode of Stanley Tucci Searching for Italy airs on CNN this Sunday at 9 p.m. Now, we turn to another key video from January 6th, that fateful insurrection day. Just hours before the mob attack, President Trump made a speech at a rally in which, we remember, he urged supporters to march on the Capitol and show strength. Immediately after Rudy Giuliani spoke and walked off the stage, a video began to play. Yale professor Jason Stanley, a scholar who's traced the rise of neo-fascism, dissected the video, and here he is talking to Hari Srinivasan about why he finds it so disturbing.
Christian, thanks. Jason Stanley, thanks for joining us. You have literally written the book on how fascism works, and you wrote a recent column about a video that was played right before people marched over to the Capitol and attempted the insurrection. And you went into great detail about it. So we're going to do something a little bit different. We are going to take a look at clips of video that were played to the crowd at the Ellipse on January 6th, and then we're going to have your analysis of it. All right, let's start with clip one.
What truly matters is not which party controls our government, but whether our government is controlled by the people. For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost.
That's the beginning of the video. What do you see there?
What we saw was it's Trump's inauguration speech from 2017 playing. And the images essentially begin with a Hollywood sign. So what are we being told while the voiceover tells us that the people have lost the country? And the country has been in control, under the control of a small group of elites. So who are these elites? Well, the elites are the people who control Hollywood, who run Hollywood. And in anti-Semitic ideology, that would be Jewish people run Hollywood. That's an immediate dog whistle for anti-Semites, for Jews. And then, and then in case you did miss that, we're led to Biden with a vacant look This is part of the theme of the 2020 campaign of Trump. Biden is under control by the leftists, by a shadowy group of elites, global elites, the radical left. Judeo-Bolsheviks were being told here. So Chuck Schumer is a Jewish senator, and he's wearing a kente cloth. Now, why a kente cloth? Why is that significant? Well, in the ideology of the second Ku Klux Klan, in American anti-Semitic ideology, Henry Ford's the International Jew, Jews are behind racial justice movements because they want to destroy the nation by dividing it, by encouraging minorities into a race war, by dividing the nation, a theme that occurs throughout this video, so that they can destroy the nation from within and take over with a world government. Another frame here is Pelosi flanked by two Jewish congressmen. So we again see this anti-Semitic theme. And then the world government theme is in two frames, one of the United Nations and the other of the European Union, which is the symbol of the loss of the European nation state to a supposed faceless global cabal. So, and behind this, we have the people who control Hollywood, Schumer, Schiff, and Nadler, prominent Jewish members of Congress.
Do you really think anybody that was standing at the Ellipse that day watching that video knows any references to Judeo-Bolsheviks or sees anything other than, okay, there's Biden, there's Schumer, there's Pelosi. Those are the three most powerful Democrats of the land, right? I mean, are we reading too much into it?
Hollywood? Hari, why does a Hollywood sign begin this video? So a lot of the people there in that rally, some of them would be unaware of protocols of the Elders of Zion or the International Jew or this history. But that's how dog whistles work. Dog whistles work by signaling to those who do have that ideology that that's what's going on, that the Jews are in control. But if you don't have that ideology, you're going to think there's a shadowy global elite represented by the people who control Hollywood and Chuck Schumer, Schiff, Nadler, and Pelosi. Pelosi's not Jewish. But these are red flag dog whistles for anti-Semitism. And we know that the Republican Party has increasingly leaned into using George Soros as a villainous symbol, which, when this happened in Europe and Hungary, when Viktor Orban did this, everyone in the United States, without question, said Viktor Orban is using anti-Semitic propaganda. So I'm not sure now that the United States has completely taken over this kind of propaganda, suddenly it's not supposed to be anti-Semitic.
Where does QAnon play into all of this?
So QAnon says there's an elite group, a group of elites who are controlling the Democratic Party and infiltrating the Democratic Party. They're members of the Democratic Party. And their goal is to destroy the nation, betray the nation, and destroy the nation. Donald Trump will rescue us from this. This is highly reminiscent of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory at the basis of Nazi ideology. The idea that the German nation was betrayed by an inside group of Jews who sought to destroy the nation and hand it over to a kind of global elite. QAnon mixes with that other anti-Semitic elements from history, like blood libel. So the idea is, what do these elites do? Well, they do everything from child sex rings to drinking the blood or eating the face of little children. So this is kind of protocols of the Elders of Zion plus blood libel, two traditional anti-Semitic theories rolled into one.
Here's another clip.
That all changes starting right here and right now.
So watching that, I think most people would think this looks like any campaign ad for any politician. They surround themselves with images of warships or, in this case, looking presidential, walking with the Secret Service. What disturbed you about this?
This isn't looking presidential. If presidential means the ruler of an authoritarian country, Kim Jong-un, this is looking like a dictator. This is looking like an authoritarian leader. These are the Trump years. Trump wins. America is joyous. Their leader is here. Joyous mass rallies, weeping, thank you. You see the image of a woman weeping. We owe everything to Trump, the glory. Then we have, what kind of glory did he bring? Military glory. We are our military might restored. We have him striding in front of a military guard. We see a black man and a white man together in brotherhood. It is in worship of Trump at rallies of adulation for Trump that racial division is healed. So this is not about the president. This is about the leader of an authoritarian mass movement.
Okay, here's the next section of the video. So again, what's problematic here? I mean, he is looking presidential. He's watching a space shuttle a rocket take off. There's, stealth fighters in the sky. I mean, this looks like it could be an ad for any second term president. This could be footage that you could swap in a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama, them saluting troops. What's wrong with this? Why is this part of this kind of fascist trope that you're concerned about?
So let's break down fascism quickly. Fascism is a cult of the leader who promises national restoration in the face of supposed humiliation brought on by leftists, liberals, elites, minorities, social justice movements. He promises to restore the nation, but the nation he promises to restore is something the scholar of Nazism, Jeffrey Herf, calls reactionary modernism. It's a glorious technological future where the military is the most powerful in the world. The Nazis loved rocket technology. The V2 rocket was this symbol of Nazi power and might. That's what's hilarious about the video, is that for those of us who know history, it's a direct reference to the kind of obsession with rocket technology that National Socialism had. As Hitler says, science is just there for the glorification of the nation. So this is a cult of the leader we're seeing in both of these past few clips. The leader, we owe everything to Donald Trump. Then we end with that clip in a picture of a cabinet meeting. But every face is fuzzed out except for Donald Trump's. So every face. So it's not a democracy. There's no way President Obama or President Clinton or President Bush, for that matter, would have a cabinet meeting with every face fuzzed out but theirs. That is a remarkably startling. What we're being told is there is only one leader.
All right, what's wrong here? We see obviously imagery that harkens to COVID and the devastating impact that it's had on our economy, making things empty. What do you see?
So right before this clip, we saw the glorious Trump years, our leader being adulated. Now we see a smirking Joe Biden. We see Bill Barr testifying before Congress. Betrayal has started. So all the legal troubles the Trump administration faced were not the Trump administration's fault. It was a plot. It was a plot of the Democrats. Then we see COVID, scene after scene of COVID, suggesting that Joe Biden is behind the COVID pandemic, that the Democrats used the COVID pandemic to destroy the country as a means of electoral success.
And what do you see at the end of this video in the final clip?
we see in this final clip what our future is if we can restore Trump after this terrible betrayal. Our promise is racial unity under Christianity. So there's a scene of a black man and a white man embracing, with the white man saying it with a Jesus Saves t-shirt. So we're being told, you know, we can get racial unity under Christianity, in Trump rallies, adulation of the leader. We can get racial unity. We can get prosperity. We can fill our cities back up again. We can get away from this treacherous COVID policy that has bankrupted the nation and immiserated its people. There's been treachery and betrayal, and this treachery and betrayal needs revenge. And the reward for this revenge will be normal life again under the leadership of Donald Trump.
Now, to be clear, we don't know who paid for the production. At this point, when we're having this conversation, there's not yet a connection between the Republican National Party funding this, the creation of this video. That said, well, here we are also in the context of an impeachment trial that's happening right now and trying to place the responsibility upon the acts that happened right after this video, right after the rally here in D.C., on the president. So why does this 2-minute clip matter? How does it play into the context of what else happened that morning that led to the attack on the Capitol?
So what we have framing this video, and this video is a contribution to that frame, is the thought that there was treachery. Elites betrayed the United States. The video suggests COVID was, without saying, suggests that COVID was some kind of plot. The election was supposedly stolen. Think of what these rallies are called, Stop the Steal rallies. Well, that presupposes that the election was stolen. It doesn't even say it. It presupposes it. The entire rally was filled with a frame of warriors and fighting. Trump urged people to fight. The trial by combat, Giuliani said right before the showing of this video. Violence requires a justification. That's why war propaganda always focuses on treachery. War propaganda always focuses on a theme of revenge. You can't get people to risk their lives and well-being unless they feel it's for a greater cause. This video is asking you to, in the words of the rally goers, fight for Trump. It's a call for violence, and it's within a larger context that's telling people, that's presupposing that there was treachery and calling on people to get revenge for that treachery.
Were you surprised at the violence after this rally?
No.
Why not?
So when the president of the United States is with such authority, is lying so openly as he has been doing and telling you you've been betrayed, this is exactly the kind of thing that incites people to what they feel is justified violence. Mass violence requires a justification. It requires someone to tell you that the violent acts that you take are justified. And we've been seeing this rhetoric for years, and it's been amplified more recently. If you look at history, there's always a period, be it a year, 3 years, even 5 years, where you get this violent rhetoric against minorities, against political opponents, and then it bursts into violence, where the people doing the violence then feel justified. They can do these incredible acts. So for me, as a scholar of this history and a theorist of this language of propaganda, I was just waiting for this.
You know, we could also look at this and say, look, this entire premise, the video and everything else, was rejected. The system did catch up, that he has been deplatformed off of social media. He has been voted out of office. He no longer has the nuclear codes. What's to worry?
The movement has shown what's possible. Any sophisticated authoritarian can see the United States is not as stable as many took it to be. If you look at the background conditions in the United States of racial division, of extreme racial division, of elite betrayal, you know, people are perfectly right to say that the economic inequality that has been happening is, there's no justification for it. It is a kind of elite betrayal. And what we've seen is people need meaning. And our structures here are ripe for takeover. I mean, the Republican Party very quickly folded into a cult of the leader. In the Republican National Convention, their platform was just whatever Trump wanted. The Republicans have not shown independence of Trump. Any smart would-be authoritarian sees that there is a path in the United States to taking over the Republican Party and ruling from there.
Jason Stanley of Yale and author of the book, How Fascism Works. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Which is why President Biden's stated goal of re-strengthening American institutions and its democratic example is so vital. That is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. And coming up next is special coverage of the Trump impeachment trial. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.